It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The 2015 Children's and Young Adult Literature Festival has gotten underway this week, and we'll bring you some of the authors. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Festival has become a major tradition on the campus of Salisbury University, and its event highlights the diversity of such literature throughout the world. They hail from as far away as Australia and Gambia. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking with some of the authors. And as a matter of fact, we're going to start off with an interesting book, which is called One Plastic Bag, Aissatou Cissé and the Recycling Women of Gambia. And we have both Cissé and Miranda in the studio. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I want to start out with Miranda first. So how did you get involved with this idea of first of all, become aware of what was going on in terms of the plastic bags, and then the idea of creating this illustrated book, this children's book?
Well, I first went to the Gambia as a volunteer teacher, starting a teacher exchange project through St. Mary's College of Maryland, and that was in 2003. And I had a wonderful experience, but I did see that no waste management system in the country was a big problem, especially in relationship to plastic, which never goes away. It just accumulates and accumulates. I thought it was kind of too big of a problem to be fixed, but another Peace Corps volunteer handed me a beautiful purse made out of recycled plastic bags and said there was a woman upcountry, you know, from a very rural village who had had enough of it. And she decided that she was going to do something about it. And in 1997, she had actually started this. And I said, wow, I need to meet that woman at some point. And then I did eventually meet her. And that was Aissatou Cissé.
Tell me a little about how you got involved. This sparked your attention in terms of getting the villagers together, and what was the first reaction to this whole idea that well, maybe we should be doing something like particularly the purses. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the idea that comes to us first is like we look at our environment, and there are a lot of plastics that people throw away, and then there are a lot of incidents like animals, they come across with them and eat them, and at the end of the day, they will die. And then the women, they use plastic to light fire when they are cooking. And we all know about what smoke is doing, especially when it is plastic. So these are all things that I really look around. And then even when we are doing our gardening activities, we so of our crops die. And then when you look underneath, you find plastic underneath. So these are all problems that I come across. And I come with the idea and said, yeah, now I think we need to sit together and see what we can do with this.
So, what was your reaction when you began to realize what this plastic was doing? Obviously we're talking about the goats, but the animals, and I mean, did you have an emotional reaction to this?
Yeah, I really have. Like, I was really sad about it because, you know, in our country, most of the women, they don't believe on savings account. What do we believe on? Whenever you have a lot of money, you buy goats or you buy ships. And when they die, you lose a lot of money. And those monies, that's what we use when we have emergency, like when our children are sick, or when we get sick, or we want to buy things, that's what we use for emergency. Mm. So I feel like we are losing a lot of our assets. So we have to, you know, think about solutions for it.
So what was the reaction when you suggested that this was a good idea, or you began doing it? And in the book, it almost as if sounds as if you kind of did it in secret for a little while. What was going through your mind?
Yeah, you know, what happened is like, when I was studying it, what I was thinking is women empowerment. And it's a big word that people think about, you know, especially when you are in Africa. You know, we have a lot of cultures, and then men tend to be like leading everything. So they believe that when I empower the women, when I give them opportunities to do something that will empower them, they will never respect them. And that was not my objective. My objective was, I believe that women can do something. And then if we involve women together with men, we can make a big impact. So it was like something very new to them. To them, because whatever new, whatever things new, whatever you're doing when it is new, you know, you have two minds. But now they understand that it's something that's going to help us in this generation and next generation. All of us, we cooperated and worked together.
So what was it like, by the way, in terms of the women? Because it indicates, I think in the book, but I also read that there was a sense of empowerment, a sense of being able to control, I guess, as it were, your environment and to make a serious contribution.
Yeah, you know, like at the beginning, it was idea of environmental cleaning, but it led us to income generation. So that income generation, that's where they think that when the women have something, they will not respect them. But on the whole, that was not the idea. The idea was, how can we believe that men and women, they should work together? How can we believe that partners, husband and wife, is more of partners that work together, think together, and move things together? It was like something that they don't understand. Because any beginning, you know, if you don't understand things, you don't understand it. But later on, when they learn that, when women are empowered in terms of income generation, at the end of the day, whatever they have, they will bring it home and they will work together to develop themselves. You know, they understand it and they love it and they support us.
By the way, was there a difference in terms of reaction between the women in the village and the men in the village to this effort?
Like to
what was because were men more accepting or less accepting? Were women more accepting, not accepting? What was there any difference between the?
Yeah, at the beginning, the women, they have more education about it because we started it. You know, later on, the men, they come in and they, you know, learn about it. They learn the disadvantage. They learn what's happened and what is the problem. And when they understand it, we come together and work as team.
I think she had told me that it took about a year before some of the men came and found them. What, you know, where is this money coming from? And what is the plastic bag project about? That it took about a year, was it, before men really started inquiring about what they were actually doing and what was the thought behind it? But now they have, I think you have seven men.
Working. And at the beginning, we have only one man who joined us.
Oh, is that right?
By the name Iliman Sise. He's the first man who joined us. And he was like receiving so many, you know, names from men. You always after the women. Why are you aftering them? And that's the opportunity that he used to educate the men. Tell them what is inside, what is the nitty-gritties that people should understand to be able to work together and then make a change, which is not difficult, which is not easy.
So did you keep this from the village for about a year, or was it known that you were doing this, but people didn't inquire in terms of what you were doing?
What is that?
Yeah. Some people, you know, people knew about it. Even, you know, members of her family, they knew about it and what she was doing. But even her own mom, you know, can say, you know, maybe please can you stop doing this because people are saying things about you and people are this and that.
Yeah, you know, what I believe is anything new is always like that. If people don't know, they don't know. But, you know, I'm so glad that they don't know, but they were ready to learn, to understand. So when they understand, it takes us very easy now. Because now we are ready to, you know, we have a long-term and short-term plans. The long-term plan is like to make sure that everybody who really have the same problem that we have, we are praying to get into that environment and educate them so that, you know, development will be kind of rapid to all of the Gambian people and African people. As well.
Describe for me, by the way, these persons. You have a couple of them actually in, and I guess they're blue or there's some blue decoration. How do you make these?
You know, what we do is when we collected first, we wash them and then cut them into one street and then weave them, like crochet them. And then when crocheting them, you can make the patterns. We make different patterns.
Most of the bags are actually black and blue in color. Those are just most of the plastic bags that are made in factories outside the Gambia, but shipped in for business purposes or this and that. But the shiny black ones, they actually recycle VHS videotapes, mostly from the Gambian radio and TV service that have all these videotapes that they're just going to throw away. And so they say, you know, anything that they can that's going to get thrown away or thrown on the ground, basically. They try to find a use for it. So they recycle bicycle tires. Recycle even the scraps. They put them inside football, soccer balls for the kids. I mean, they try to use every piece of plastic that they can.
So tell me then a little bit about how you then developed this book and why did you decide to make it a children's book?
That's a really good question. You know, there's so much to Isatou's story that when I first began interviewing her and the women, you know, I thought about a longer book or helping her write her memoir, and that, you know, could be a possibility in the future. But as I personally, I'm a former teacher and I was really focused on children's literature at the time. I said, the story, if I just take out the part of you starting the project, which is quite an amazing and remarkable story in and of itself, and the fact that I've seen it over the course of, you know, almost a decade, what it's done for the village is that would make a really remarkable story for young kids, because they understand plastic. It's all part of their lives now, you know, kids in America, kids pretty much anywhere, but also they will understand the concept of having an idea and not everyone around them is taking them seriously. You know, we do that sometimes. Kids have these ideas and we laugh at them or call them cute or this and that. But, you know, kids do have great ideas, and to teach them a little bit about, here's a real woman who did this. She had an idea. She knew it was a good thing to do. And despite some people laughing at her or calling her dirty, she kept at it and look what she accomplished. And so I thought that was just a really powerful way to, you know, write it. And I wanted it to be illustrated because this is, as far as I know, the first traditionally published picture book about a real Gambian woman ever in the United States. And so I thought it was important to have that visual representation of the landscape, the culture, the people.
So what was, first of all, Miranda, what was your reaction when you finally saw the book and the cover? What was your reaction to it?
It was stunning. Elizabeth Zunan is the illustrator, and she grew up in West Africa in a country called the Ivory Coast. And she, she got it right. You know, the details of the book, Isatou being left-handed, the patterns, the clothing, but also that, you know, the way that she mixed, you know, these beautiful paintings and the collage and the actual plastic bags. It's just remarkable, the illustrations. I actually had a very emotional reaction when I saw it, because it's been 12 years since I first was handed a recycled plastic purse until now. So this is quite a long journey, but I've learned the power of patience and persistence from Isatou.
Isatou, of course, and we should mention that the front of the picture of the book has you prominently on it, looking out, and there are, I guess there's a plastic bag or two down below. Mm-hmm. And then we have a couple of, looks like goats or at least animals of some kind in the background, and sort of a, I couldn't figure out whether this was a sun or whether it's the, is it the sun? Okay,
it
with
is.
Multicolor. When I said, when you saw it, what was your reaction, particularly seeing yourself on this book?
I was so happy, extremely happy, because, you know, the colors that they put into the, you know, the colors that they use, definitely those are my colors. And all what they put into the book, the story is exactly how it works. So I was really happy about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what has been, if you have any kind of reaction from the folks in your village to this book and the publishing of this book? Have they seen the book yet?
Yeah, they see the first copy.
Uh-huh.
And when I show it to them, all of them, they were so happy. And they believe that now, yes, we get there. Because this is what we were struggling, so that people get to know the story that we want to, you know, the change that we want to do, people know about it. And now we believe that, you know, throughout the world, everybody, you know, most of so many people, they read about the book. So many people, they know about us. And it will teach other people to believe whatever they want to do, and then believe themselves and keep going. And then, you know, if you believe what you are doing and you keep going, you get there.
Mm-hmm. Has the government helped you out at all? Or is this real just an initiative?
Yeah, they really give us the environment.
You know,
they help us a lot. They give us the environment and they motivate us.
Well, we're speaking with Isatou Cisse and Miranda Paul. And of course, Isatou she has the focus of this book in terms of recycling bags. And they will, of course, be at the Children's and Young Adults Festival here in Salisbury University, and we appreciate you taking the time to stop by and talk with us.
Thank you very much. Or Jared Jeff in Willow.
We want to turn to Kwame Alexander. He's a poet, a playwright, producer, and an author. He regularly conducts creative writing workshops and performances in middle schools and high schools. He also awarded the 2015 John Newbery Medal for the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children. And highlighting this year's appearance at the Children's and Adult Literature Festival is the work, The Crossover. And it's about two 12-year-old twins, Josh and Jordan Bell, who are fairly good on the basketball court, but then they must face up to also growing up. And we have Kwame on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me ask you this. So what is the origin of this, the story for you? It's about these two brothers and obviously, and about their father, who actually played professional, it sounds like, basketball. Tell me a little bit about the story and why you, how you came about to write this.
Well, I wanted to write a book
that I knew boys would not be able to put down. Well, first of all, they would be able, they'd want to pick it up. And then once they sort of read the first page, the first poem, they wouldn't want to put it down. I remember when I was a child, I used to love hearing my mother read to me. I love read aloud. I love going to bed reading stories. And something happened when I got to middle school. I stopped finding the joy in reading because I wasn't being given books that were of interest to me, that were exciting and engaging for me. So my first sort of goal with this book was to sit down and write a book that I would have loved to read as a boy. And then in terms of the story, you know, basketball is sort of a hook to get boys excited, to get, you know, girls excited. But I thought that sort of the overarching themes were going to be family, brotherhood, love, jealousy, and sort of coming of age from a child to sort of a young adult. So those were some of the things that I wanted to tackle, and I tried to use poetry to do that.
But as a matter of fact, I'll just read just a little couple of lines here. And this is when Josh Bell is on the court itself. And it says, just read it a little. With a bolt of lightning on my kicks, the court is sizzling. My sweat is drizzling. Stop all that quivering, because tonight I'm delivering. And what I found interesting, and you do this a number of times throughout the book in terms of them being on the court, and one of the things that you do on the page, it's almost an E. Cummings sort of approach, is that the words, particularly for the basketball game, they kind of like slur across the page in terms of their actual presentation. What was the thinking behind that?
Wow. Well, first of all, you have spoken to my poetic heart by mentioning me in the same sentence as E. Cummings. Whom I absolutely love, and I love because of the way his poetry is so original, and the way visually, you know, it says something. And I knew that the poems had to be read a certain way. Some of the poems had to be read a certain way, and in order for me to sort of convey that, I needed to show on the page how the poems read, how the words looked. If the poem had the word sort of slipping, then I needed to have the word slipping so that when reluctant readers sort of picked up this book, they would sort of, you know, be immersed in this beauty, this beautiful landscape of poetry that I find so dear to my writing career.
Now, obviously we have the two boys, the two brothers, but we have his father who is bigger than life, certainly for both of them. He was at once certainly a star, upcoming star. Tell us a little bit about him. And he almost seems like there's a certain tragic quality to him and to his life.
Well, you know, it's really, people often ask me, was I writing about my dad? And to a certain degree, I was, but I was really writing about, you know, fatherhood in general and how, you know, mothers are the ones who sort of get the credit for being the emotional caregivers and nurturers and justifiably. I mean, that's what happened. It happened in my house. My mother was the one who said, I love you all the time. My mother was the one who was constantly nurturing. And so that's a characteristic that we attribute to mothers. And I thought, you know, for a father, you know, I have two daughters. I have a 6-year-old and I have a 24-year-old. And I am constantly trying to be that nurturing figure in their lives. And I thought, well, let me try to illustrate the role that I think fathers don't get credit for, or that fathers should be more involved in their children's lives. And so I wanted to create this sort of father who was loving, who was funny, who was intimately involved in his son's lives, and then of course the tragedy that you speak of. I think it's just life in terms of how sort of the challenges that this man has had in his life. I mean, granted, he was a professional basketball player. He made money doing that. He has a wonderful family. You know, he's a pretty smart man. But you know, as in life, things happen, and so we all have our challenges. And I think at some point I knew that the challenges that he faced in this in the lives of his family were going to be sort of the challenge that impacted his entire family.
I mean, the sense I got, by the way, about him was that he was almost bigger than life. I mean,
No, it's true because, you know, and I think that comes from my dad sort of being larger in life. My dad was a basketball player, a pretty good one in college and in the Air Force. And then he decided to become an intellectual, or he was always an intellectual. He didn't just decide that. He decided to become an academic and got his PhD and sort of went on a different path. But even in regards to his sort of bookish life, he became larger than life for me. As a son, sort of looking at him and his love of words and books, and so I wanted to sort of mirror that in the book. And how often in this life do we sort of think of men, of black men in particular, but men in general, as sort of being the sort of also ran in the familial world of raising a family? I mean, the men go out and do the jobs, and you know. And so we get sort of used to that sort of archetype. But I wanted for this man, for this father, to sort of be larger than life, not only in his professional world, but in the minds and the hearts of his boys.
Tell me a little bit about Josh, because he seems to be sort of the main character through which everything itself begins to. We see the story itself, and obviously as things are beginning to change inside of his family.
I'm just worried that it won't be.
Kwame, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell me a little bit about Josh.
Wow, Josh, I think that when I sat down to write the character of Josh, I really went back to sort of my childhood as of being this sort of nerd. I don't know if I was a self-described nerd, but that's what I was sort of labeled as, and very much into books because of the household that I was raised in. But at the same time, trying to sort of find my cool, and I was able to do that by attempting to play basketball, not being very good, but really finding my rhythm on the tennis court and becoming a pretty good tennis player. So being an athlete to a certain degree provided a certain balance of coolness to my bookishness. And so I wanted to create this character who was extremely smart, whose vocabulary was quite deep. And at the same time, he had a certain level of cool with him. And I tried to do that in terms of the way he talked and the way he communicated. And of course, a lot of kids and a lot of reviewers have said, wow, Josh is a rapping, hip-hopping kid. And of course, when I set out to write it, I was not thinking of rap or hip-hop. I was just thinking of this cool kid who communicates mainly, you know, in his mind, you know, through these sort of internal conversations through the use of rhyme. But, you know, I'll take whatever kids get from it as long as they're engaged. So I tried to create that sort of character who was balanced with coolness and bookishness, which was sort of a direct take or steal or borrow from my own life.
Well, finally, before we go to the next author, I wanted to, you also wrote a book called He Said, She Said, and a quote here. From the quote, it says, he says Omar T. Diddy Smalls has got it made, a full football ride to UMiami, hero worship status at school, and a pick of any girl at West Charleston High. She says, football, here's what Chloe Clark cares about, Harvard, the poor, the disenfranchised, the hungry, the staggering teen pregnancy rate, investigative journalism, the list goes on. She does not have a minute to waste for Mr. T. Diddy Smalls and his harem of bimbos. Tell me a little bit about, just a bit touched anyway, about that book, because when I read those, by the way, those lines, they were just such stark contrast, such stark relief in terms of the writing that you're producing and the contrast between these two views of life.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that I wanted to sort of create this. I wanted to create a book, a literature that really showcased the activism that is and can take place on college campuses and high school campuses around the country, and how students, when sort of given the opportunity, can show you that they are interested in things that are just beyond their own, you know, Twitter feed or their own sort of identities, that they really want to and do have the power to change the world. And so that really became the thrust for that book, to create an activist book to show students what's possible and how they need to sort of take control of their destiny. The idea behind the relationship, the love story, was more sort of a, again, it was a hook. It was, how do you create sort of this standard, you know, conflict of the boy who's from one side of the track and the girl who's from the other side of the track, and sort of bring them, you know, how do they come together? And of course, generally they come together and they fall in love or you know, or something romantic happens. But in this book, I wanted those two sort of sides of the track to come together to, you know, I know in a really general, broad kind of way, to change the world. And so that became the love story became the hook for the book, much like basketball became the hook in the crossover.
We've been speaking with Kwame Alexander. He's a poet, playwright, and producer, as well as an author. And his latest book, The Crossover, which we highlighted at the Children's and Adult Literature Festival here on the campus of Salisbury University. And Kwame, appreciate you joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Before we go on, I just want to indicate we're going to want to be joined by Ernie Bond here in a moment, if he can come on in. And I want to now turn to Suzanne Gervais. She was born in Sydney, Australia, after her parents escaped from a communist Hungary in the post-Second World War period. In 2007, she earned the Lady Cutler Award for Distinguished Services to the Children's Literature. And her work, of course, has been driven by the rights of children and families. She's written a series of books involving a character named Jack. And her latest entry, by the way, is entitled I Am Jack. And this book itself focuses on bullying, a topic which, of course, has risen to the surface here in the United States of great concern over the last few years. Welcome to the program.
Very happy to join you.
So let me ask you a little bit about Jack himself, because you've actually written a series of books which seem to do or touch various different themes. What's the origin for Jack?
Well, the origin is my really gorgeous but annoying son. And I'm a normal parent, which means that I love my kids, but we're really, really busy, and we work and we do all the things parents do. And I really didn't notice that my son had become targeted and a serious victim of bullying. And that's really how the whole series began. It was really that realization that a parent who is caring and is aware of problems that can arise in the schoolyard, didn't notice, didn't see. And when it was discovered, I of course went into full parent mode, and you know, we fought it together, and he won against bullying eventually, and it was very difficult. But after it, I asked him, is it all right if I would write that for other kids? And he was fabulous, and he said, yes, Mum, please write it for kids who get bullied and who bully others and teachers and parents, to try and emotionally engage them so we get a safer world and a safer schoolyard.
Let me ask you this. Was there any indications why how he particularly became the target, and was there any indication at all as to why him as opposed to, say, somebody else?
You know, one of the wrong beliefs is that kids who are bullied are strange, they're, you know, bright or dumb, or they've got one parent or two parents, and that's not really the truth. Bullying is all about power abuse. It's about isolating a child and letting this peer group, and this peer group develops to target them. And it's a real concern that that people are looking at the victim, the kid who's bullied, but somehow they instigated it, or somehow there's something in them. The only common quality in kids who are targeted is that they tend to be empathetic. That's all, which is a wonderful quality to have as an adult, but it does make you vulnerable. But apart from that, it's all about victimization. There is no reason other than one kid becomes isolated, the friends leave, and they become a game. Just a kid who's a leader who decides to bully another kid for fun, gets supporters, and the kid, like my Jack, becomes disempowered and unable to counter it.
So is there any indication to what kind of personalities go ahead and bully other other kids? What can you tell me about that?
Well, kids who bully others, sometimes people feel, you know, they're monsters, and they're not. They're us. We bully others. Good kids bully. The common quality is basically lack of empathy. They're having a game. They're having a good time. You know, a kid who bullies my son, or a girl, a boy, anyone, often it's because they are basically showing off. They're getting lots of people following them. They're having a great time, and they actually can't understand or empathize with the child they're victimizing. It's a game. And sometimes there are reasons, like, the kid who's a bully could, you know, have a bad background, or, you know, may have a learning disability. But that's not really the main reason. The main reason is they are doing it for themselves. They are leading in the wrong way. And they're having a great time. They're getting away with it. They're becoming cool. It's fun. And they don't actually realize they're destroying another human being. Often those kids who bully, when they become adults, are really pretty ashamed of it, often.
Now, one of the things that was not around when I was growing up was cyberspace and cyberbullying. And I don't know whether necessarily schoolyard taunts have necessarily declined or not, but certainly cyberbullying has created a whole new venue for this kind of thing. How do you see that differing from what we, certainly I grew up as this sort of physical in a single space kind of bullying in a schoolyard, as opposed to cyberbullying, which seems to have a much, much greater power than just simply one place, one instance where, okay, and then you escape. It's this, the cyberspace is like everywhere continuously.
Look, cyberbullying is another methodology of power abuse. And it's really, really important to look at the core issue of bullying, which is basically a stronger group destroying a weaker person or group. Cyberbullying, yes, is another tool, and it can spread. But all the latest studies show the most destructive form of bullying is still within the playground, is within that personal social group. And my argument is this, that in World War II, 6 million Jews were put in concentration camps and killed, and there was no cyberbullying. Cyberbullying is just another tool, and it does have to be addressed. But what I try to do in my I Am Jack books is to change culture so that when another kid sees and their friends see a child being targeted, be it Jack or Jane, they act to stop it by including that child in their group, by, if it is cyberbullying and the messages go out, you know, counter it, right? You know, stop that child or put out your own messages. There's lots of, it's all about supporting a child who is being targeted. And that is, you know, that is more than cyberbullying. That's just another tool of spreading that power abuse.
Now, as a writer, I was running, sort of reading about you, and you said that that you write about people, places, emotions that touch you, but then you said you find writing hard. Why do you find writing hard?
Well, I find writing hard because I tell the truth and I mind my own feelings and inadequacies. One thing I really believe is that young people feel everything and they have no experience to deal with it. So I share my experience and vulnerability with young people. I'm really honest. And as a result, I put myself at risk. I find that really hard. That's the first thing. And the second thing that's hard is that I have a really strong social justice agenda. I really want to stop power abuse. I really want to help kids who are, you know, feeling isolated when parents fight or argue. I want to be there. I want my books to be their friends. And the thing is, what's hard is to make sure that I am not didactic. I am not telling them what to do. So in my books, I want to open strategies and choices so that they make the decision about how they live their life, because that empowers them so that they can deal with all the challenges that life will throw up at them.
Do you think that children do get lost in adult agendas when it comes to their search for identity?
Yeah, kids do get lost. I think that there's enormous pressure on young people, even though we live, you know, in such, you know, Western societies which offer so many opportunities. The thing is that kids do get lost because there's a lot of freedom, and with freedom comes a lot of responsibility. And I just think there's huge pressure on kids to, you know, achieve outstanding results, and they feel they can't meet their parental expectations. Families are breaking up. You know, kids often have responsibilities that, you know, schools don't know they face. You know, looking after other kids, dealing with, you know, absentee parents, all sorts of things, and their own sense of self-worth. And you know what? The real issue is with story. Is we want to give kids a voice, because we don't want them to meet these challenges and feel trapped. Kids are really different to adults. We as adults know that life is filled with obstacles and there's bad times, but ultimately we will overcome it and move on. Young people are different. When they face a real challenge, they actually think there is no hope. And that's part of the reason we have such a high level of youth suicide, especially with boys, because they don't have a tradition of sharing and talking. They have to deal with these issues alone, and they often feel there's no out, and they die. And that is just unacceptable. And that's part of the reason, or one of the major reasons I write, so that when young people feel there is no way out, go into story and there's a friend there, and they will find answers that help them go on.
I'm reading, and it describes, and I don't know whether you've described it, your writing as adult social realism. And I know that aside from I Am Jack, you've also written, I guess it was a book, Always Jack, which is about an experience with cancer. How do you define what adult social realism is? Or, I mean, is that an adequate description of what you're doing?
I like the term social realism. I just think that I write about realistic life, what really happens. Social realism is a term I use in order to say that I write about real life, but there are real issues that I'm dealing with. And that will become part of their lives. You know what? Kids know and feel everything. They just don't know how to process it. And they don't know, and especially in young adult years, they are so vulnerable, despite their big mouths. They are extremely vulnerable. And they just don't know how to ask for help, because it sort of threatens their own sense of independence. So social realism is their lives and how they're going to relate to other people and their own expectations and hopes and dreams. And I write that, and I really write from a very deeply ethical place. I do. And I want to empower them so that they don't die, so that they make positive choices for their own lives.
Right. What I mentioned earlier as an introduction that your parents actually escaped from Hungary in the post-war period, which is communist Hungary. What kind of influence did your parents have and their experience as it relates to you have on your writing, do you think?
My parents, yes, they did escape from Hungary. They were refugees. The impact of growing up from a refugee family deeply impacts on all my writing. I really thought about it recently. They were able to cope with enormous abuse. My father was in forced labor, so you can imagine there was torture and so on. They experienced enormous loss to come to the West and rebuild their lives. I believe that drives every single book I write, every single word I write. I believe that life offers terrible challenges at times, and I want to inspire young people to know that through love, through self-belief, you can be all that you can be. And that really drives everything I write.
By the way, what has been the reaction then to the series of books? Do people follow this character? What's been the reaction?
This is my last one. I've been through school. I'm just going to say, my book, I Am Jack series, it has an enormous following. It's read by nearly every child and family in Australia. It's been adapted into a play which is going to tour again Australian theatres and the US in US theatre, again a second tour. The impact is that, true story, young people and parents are get insight into how power abuse happens, and they basically find a friend in my books, and it helps them to deal with the challenges that bullying faces. They face with bullying, both as a bullying community, parents and teachers. It's had enormous impact in Australia, and I'm really thrilled that it's come to America, and also that the play is going to tour again. It's exciting. And I have to go to a school now.
All right. Well, and I do appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.
We've been speaking with Suzanne Gervais. She was born in Sydney, is author of I Am Jack, which is a young person's book about the issue of bullying. And she hails, of course, from Australia. And we do certainly appreciate her joining us. I want to now turn to the man of the hour, which is Ernie Bond. He's the guy who puts all of this together. He organizes the Children's Literature and Young Adult Festival. So, Ernie, are you impressed with the kind of material that you've seen, and particularly that you've been able to gather here on the campus of Salisbury University?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've been doing this for several decades now, but this year is an incredible collection of authors and illustrators coming together with the focus of diverse voices. And I think the people we have coming, you got to hear from four of them this morning. There's four others who are out in schools right now. I think they're visiting 14 different schools yesterday, today, and next Monday. Also, Suzanne spoke to the young author reception last night, which was around 150 people came to hear her speak. Next Tuesday, Brian Collier, who's originally from Maryland, from Pocomoke, Maryland, is speaking to around 250 kids from the local area. So it's great to have these incredible authors, illustrators, environmental activists all coming together and really impacting. I mean, over 1,000 kids are going to get to experience these authors and illustrators. And then Miranda and Isatu are speaking to the Eastern Shore Reading Council on Monday night. So the being able to meet with award-winning authors, award-winning illustrators, people who are really impacting, and not just on the national level, but the international level. It's incredible that in Salisbury we can get Australian authors coming, award-winning Australian authors. James Roy, one of the authors who's out in the school right now, won the Premier's Award in Australia a few years ago, which is the big children's literature award in Australia. And then we have Isatou coming all the way from Gambia to join us, which is just incredible that we have this possibility on the Eastern Shore to meet with all of these people and to hear diverse perspectives, to hear diverse voices from around the world and from around the country.
But Ernie, have you seen a change in children's literature over the years that you've been doing this? Has it become more sophisticated, less sophisticated? Is there certain areas that are now being emphasized as opposed to other areas? What's your reading about this?
Well, it's always shifting a bit. I mean, there's trends that come and go. The dystopian and paranormal romance and that type of thing was really hitting hard for a while. One of the things that I should mention, something that's had a huge impact this past year, is a new group called We Need Diverse Voices. Tell us the name, Miranda. Miranda is one of the people who's created this organization.
Yeah, We Need Diverse Books is the name of the organization. I'm a vice president of outreach for We Need Diverse Books, but it's just a grassroots organization, a 501c3 of children's book lovers that advocates essential changes in the publishing industry to promote literature that reflects and honors the lives of all people. So quite a range. We have subscribed to a wide range of diverse experiences that we want to see more representation in children's books.
How did the organization come about?
Well, our president, Ellen O, and some of her colleagues, many people have been having this discussion for years. This Cooperative Center for Children's Books, the CCBC in Madison, Wisconsin, puts out statistics every year of, there's about 5,000 children's books that come out each year. And what percentage, feature diverse main characters, and what percentage are by diverse authors or illustrators? And the numbers are dismally, they have been dismally low, and they've actually got worse for a time. And so these conversations began online, a lineup at a very prominent children's literature conference was announced. And once again, it was a very homogenous group of men, invited, or a homogenous group of authors coming up. And there was a group of us that just said, we've had enough. Conversations began. And then the hashtag, we were first known as the hashtag that went around the world, like two or three days before we even had our official campaign, we were getting, trending on Twitter. And then we turned that into an organization that really runs a number of programs now, trying to be that change and get the books prominently displayed, or get the authors, diverse authors, more of them, advocating for them, because we want to see the kids, our population in America. We want to see those kids, books that are written for those kids, and authors that represent that, our kids in America today.
Go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. We have 800 pre-service teachers at Salisbury University who are becoming elementary and early childhood teachers. And they come in to the program with this idea that literature has changed the experiences that kids can encounter in literature. There's got to be all this diversity now. And then they're shocked when they find out that there were more diverse books being published in the 80s than there are now.
Why was that?
Well, I mean, it's in part the publishing industry, and there's a lot of debate about why this happens. Yeah. I mean, definitely it's the marketing people in the publishing industry who are trying to find the next book that's going to win the Caldecott Award or the Newbery Award, because those are the big sellers. And, we have conversations about the fact that you don't get Newbery Award, when you don't get children's books with African Americans or Latinos on the cover of the book. If it's written with a character of color, the marketing people or somebody at the publishing house will often decide, oh, well, let's just have a bowl of goldfish on the cover, because characters of color don't sell. They're not going to buy the books. And I think that's a real misconception, but it's something that happens. So anyway, the publishers aren't publishing as many books buying about people of color, but they're also... some strange things like, a few authors have really gotten upset when their book comes out and you can't tell who the main character is by looking at the cover of the book. But anyway, the teachers are all thinking, this is 2015, there must be so many books that we can have in our classroom that have diverse experiences that kids can get excited about, that they can see themselves in the narratives and see how other people think and feel and live. But it's just not the case. You can find a lot of good books. But there should be so many more coming out. And that's why We Need Diverse Books is such an important organization, because it's calling attention to the fact that we need more books coming out, buying about people of color, more international books, which in the U.S., only about 3-4% of the books that are published in the U.S. are coming from other countries. How are kids going to learn what it's like to be in China, what it's like to be in Africa, what it's like to be in Brazil? I mean, there's some incredible literature around the world that, when you think about it, if we're only reading the best literature and being exposed to the best art that's coming out in the U.S., that's just a small fraction of the incredible literary and aesthetic experiences that we could have if we were exposed to the best literature from around the world, the best literature that carries voices and experiences from all over. So that's one of my pet peeves, is we need more books. We need more books that can make kids excited about the world they live in.
I mean, because one of the things that we've been remarking upon is that here in the United States, there's a demographic change that's taking place. Mm-hmm. And the Hispanic community in particular is growing much faster and larger. I think by 2050 or something like that, whites, as they've been traditionally at least defined, are going to become a minority and so on. Do you think that demographic change is going to encourage also diversity in books, and that people, that they're going to find particular markets, or do you think they're going to be resistant to it? Is the old ways will?
Well, you would think that with the changing demographics in the U.S., that the children's book industry would be reflecting those changing demographics to a certain extent. So it's kind of bizarre to hear that the number of books reflecting diverse experiences have actually gone down in the past 20 years. But hopefully, well, I mean, at some point, just like in on cable TV, at some point, publishers have to say, hey, wait a second, there's a huge Latino population in the U.S. How come we're not creating more books that are going to capture that experience, that are going to really appeal to some of those readers? And you know, I mean, on the Eastern Shore, what the demographics now, what, about 15% non-native English speaker? And, you know, we need more of those books available for kids. I mean, we also need those books available for all of our kids so that we know about our world, so we know about our communities, so we know about diverse experiences.
Miranda, do you think we suffer from the idea that we don't, not just simply that there aren't children's books or a lot of children's books for all the various diverse folks in the United States, but that we don't have this sense of about what's going on beyond our borders? I mean, you did a book about Gambia. I suspect there are a lot of children who may not even know where that is.
A lot of adults.
There's a lot of adults. We've learned on the book tour here that there's, I mean, it is the smallest country on the continent of Africa. But, you know, one thing I will say about diversity and about We Need Diverse Books is that sometimes it's not just about, you know, international cultures. You know, we have, I think, disability, you know, kids with disabilities, you know, and a wide range of disabilities, physical, sensory, cognitive, intellectual, developmental, you know, illnesses. These are very, these are not represented very well in children's literature. And through some of this, even some of our, you know, gender diversity, I just read one of our board members' books, I.W. Gregorio's None of the Above, and it is about an intersex character. The main character is intersex. And growing up, I never heard that word. I never heard of
it. And define that, what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, someone is not male or female. Okay. You know, that they have, you know, maybe both, mm-hmm. You know, physically in the anatomy. And, you know, for me as an adult to read this, I said, had I read this when I was a teenager, I would have come to understand a lot more about, you know, words that my father used or ways that he would, you know, talk about intersex or transgendered individuals. I would have realized that this is a, you know, a medical condition and people were born that way. And I'm, you know, somewhat ashamed to admit that I, you know, in my 30s, I'm learning a lot about this now because it just wasn't represented in books, some of the, you know, the gender issues. And I was an adult before I had read a book also that had a lesbian character. I had never, no one had ever given me that as a child. And so I had, you know, the absence of also teaches us something than, you know, the exposure to. But there's also, you know, books that I read as a child, which, you know, were set in China or were a Chinese folktale. I can think of one in particular, but it wasn't actually a Chinese folktale. It was, you know, you know, there's, you know, sometimes as a white woman, I'm maybe a little hypersensitive to that, is that appropriating other cultures and the stereotypes that can come in when we write outside our culture and outside our own experiences, that there's a real need that we don't just need more diverse books. We need, you know, authentic representations. We need responsible representation. And I think that there are a number of groups, you know, marginalized groups, particularly American Indians or Indigenous peoples, that unfortunately get a lot of stories written about them from outsiders of the culture who aren't working with individuals within the culture. And I think that's something that we're paying more attention to in academic circles now, is that, you know, if we're going to represent cultures, that we need to do that responsibly, and we need to be inclusive and listen to those authors who have that firsthand experience.
I mean, Ernie, do you think that it's, maybe it's not impossible, but do you think that those who are outside various cultures trying to write about them, do you think that they are up to the task in terms of the material that you've seen, or does it really take somebody from a particular?
I think the less you know the culture intimately, the less you know about the life experiences, the more you're going to get wrong. Anybody who can pull it off, more power to them. But you have to, the less personal experiences you have with a culture or gender issues or bullying or anything else, the less likely you're going to be able to pull it off right and authentically about that issue or about that experience. So people who are able to do it, more power to them. People who get it wrong, they're getting it wrong. So, you know, there are people who have definitely done a good job with it. An interesting story, Chris Soonpete, who's a Korean-American illustrator, does incredible books about a lot of different cultural experiences and really does his research. Well, he had written a book that, The Last Chinese Dragon, I think it was called. It was set in Chinatown, Chinese New Year. And he happened to marry somebody who was from that culture. And after they were married, she sat down with him and showed him all the things that he had gotten wrong in his book. Now, somebody who isn't from Chinatown, who hasn't had those experiences, is going to read the book and say, oh, wow, this is a great book, wonderful, great culture being represented and whatever. Somebody from that culture reading the book is going to know all the things that were gotten wrong. Yeah, so I think you can do it. And if you do a good job with it, that's great. One of the problematic things is a lot of times those Color Me Brown books, those books that don't really have authenticity to them, take the place of the books that do have the authenticity, you know, because the teacher choosing them or the parent choosing them or whatever doesn't know the culture intimately. And they say, oh, here's a good book about Native American culture. And it's The Legend of the Indian Paintbrush, which Tommy DePaula just totally made up. It's fake lore. It's got nothing to do with fake a legend lore, from indigenous people. But if you don't know that, you accept it as, yeah, this is. So if you have a wide range of books from diverse experiences, if you have a wide range of books with Latino experiences, it's not going to be so damaging if you have some of those books that are, you know, not authentic, because kids have a lot of images of what it's like to live that life. But if those are the only books you're being exposed to and they're made up by a white author, what ideas are you getting about how people live and think and feel?
We've been speaking with Ernie Bond, and he is, of course, a Salisbury University professor, and puts together every year this Children's Literature and Young Adults Festival. And we appreciate you taking the time to stop by and talk to us. Also want to say, Suzanne Gervais, she, of course, was author of the book I Am Jack, about bullying. Also, we have Isatu Cisse and Miranda Paul, who, of course, the subject of this particular book, One Plastic Bag, and about the recycling women of Gambia, and we certainly appreciate that, as well as Kwame Alexander. He's a poet, playwright, and also producer and author, and of course his latest entry is The Crossover, and we appreciate everyone joining our program. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you for having us.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.